Where's the food? You know, because we've forgotten to train people how to grow food properly, you know, pure food, organic food. We've forgotten or have neglected to train up people, to inspire people, and to give them proper knowledge how to start self-sufficient communities, for example. I mean, that's the whole basis. Coming back to our earlier discussions, we have forgotten, as brahmanas within our ISKCON society, to know in detail why cows are so important. Brahmanas must know this. Otherwise, how are they going to teach it to others? So brahmana duty and responsibility is to learn both things of the spiritual and material level, understanding that both are actually meant to help individuals and society progress and advance towards Krishna consciousness. So the training of leaders, we're not going to go into detail, I'm just touching on it briefly. This is, of course, explained more in detail in our book on Varnashram education. Then what will also become very important is developing educational modules. We touched on this a little bit, you know, about Gurukul and Varnashram College. How these will be developed. I mean, Prabhupada wanted that we have Varnashram College in all of our temples. I mean, most of our temples are in the cities. So we have to adjust, you know. We can only teach a certain amount of what is Varnashram within the city. We'll have to bring people out in the country, you know, to teach them how to, for example, milk cows. But if we don't have any land, if we don't have devotees who know how to milk cows, if we're only hiring people to do these things also, that's not what Srila Prabhupada wanted us to do. He wanted our own devotees, you see. I mean, it's not the majority of our devotees. Even the majority of our initiated devotees who are brahmanas by nature. You see. So, developing educational modules, and these three small points, then we'll have a few minutes for some discussions. Yeah, what is like very essential, establishing models of Varnashram communities. I mean, the whole purpose why we're having this seminar is to bring this point across, which was one of the major concerns or instructions of Srila Prabhupada. I don't want to repeat what has already been heard many, many times, but we must come to that point, and our society, our ISKCON society, must give the necessary support, the necessary infrastructure, the necessary manpower, etc., to facilitate and help individuals who have some desire or some inclination or some understanding to make this become a reality. And then we need to write, you know, we need to have individuals, find individuals, or create a situation whereby individuals, brahmanas especially, can write on various aspects of Varnashrama, which will include different kinds of manuals covering the varnas and ashramas. There's a goldmine of information, actually, which most of us are unaware of, and it's not expected that all of us will need to research or gather this information. That's the job, not the job, but the service or the responsibility of those who are brahmanas. But if our brahmanas are not given that opportunity, so to speak, you know, if they are caught up in the kind of world in which we're living, whereby they have to work, etc., then it makes for a very difficult situation. I'll stop here since, to allow a little bit of time if there's any comments or any questions on what we've covered so far. Yes? Loudly, because you're very far away. We can maybe stand up, Prabhu?
Violence, or for example, for you. One is Vaishabhanecha, you shouldn't imitate Brahmana, this is not good, but you can steal, cheat, lie, but this is your nature. So,
but it's not exactly like that.
It's not
very nice. I mean, you're putting it in a way that's different than before.
What he's telling in...
You're saying that the nature of the Vaishya is to cheat, lie, and what Prabhupada is saying is more like sometimes in certain situations, in like diplomatic affairs, like a kshatriya, or in a business context, you cannot always like tell the truth, or a kshatriya may have, like in some of our farms, we have to bribe the government to get things done. You know, so in that sense, but it's not like the intention of the varnas are crooked. It's more like in reaction to the relationship with the crookedness outside that they sometimes have to adjust.
So my question is like, these are like things which sometimes appear they're not much compatible with Krishna consciousness, like politics and other things. So how to combine these two?
Yes, yes. So one of the important principles in Krishna consciousness for those who are taking up the process, spiritual process, is that one should act under the guidance of proper authority. And you know, we have been given Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. So if one is confused or not clear about given some particular situation, then one should consult with one's higher authority or one's spiritual master to understand what may be proper or may not be proper. Obviously, the Vedic literatures do not encourage people to deviate. I mean, the whole reason why the Vedic literatures are there are to give some guidelines to general society, for individuals within society, so that they can gradually become purified. Obviously, people will not become purified if they are encouraged to steal. So it is not that the Vedic literatures encourages anyone to steal, but certain individuals within society, because of the material, because of their material situation, then that activity is maybe tolerated, or it is less, it will bring less of a sinful reaction than someone who is a brahmana, for example. So one of the important aspects which we as devotees, as practicing Vaishnavas, have to deal with, of course, and that I would say is part of our difficulty in introducing or applying the system of Varnashrama, is that on the purely transcendental platform of devotional service, then all of these things which may be allowed within certain varnas, for a devotee, they should not be done. However, at the same time, it's like, as Prabhupada points out, how many devotees are actually situated on that pure transcendental platform? So, taking the guidance of the Shastra, taking the guidance of Guru, taking the guidance of other Vaishnavas, according to one's particular situation in society, then one should try to follow. I mean, the references you're making from the Bhagavad Gita are simply stating that one should act according to one's nature, as given in the Shastra. And what is allowed for someone in one particular varna is not recommended for someone in another varna. So even though we are devotees, because we're not yet pure devotees, we have to respect the guidelines, the general guidelines given in the different shastras. For example, kshatriyas. Kshatriyas, they have to fight. Kshatriyas, they have to have spies to understand about, I mean, so many things about kshatriyas, which are given in the shastra. So it is, you know, we say politics, that devotees should not do politics. Politics is the business of kshatriyas. You cannot do away with politics. course, we have generally a negative understanding, or we regard politics as something very, very bad.
Because we're not trained, so we mostly do bad politics.
Yeah.
Instead of
policy just and good politics. The same point we were making about like the word shudra. You know, shudra, we generally, when it comes, when we use the word, we think of it in a rather negative manner. So every situation will be different, every individual will be different, and we need to understand the basic principles which are given in our Shastra, how to execute or how to take up our various duties and responsibilities.
I remember one devotee was describing that if the Pandavas were to turn up at one of our temples tomorrow, probably they'd be thrown out. Because, you know, they were exactly, you know, they were gambling and,
Not after that incident, though. But there's also another meaning to that verse that you're pointing out, is that, let's say somebody is very qualified as a, or not so qualified as a Brahmana, but that's his nature, but he could become a very Pakasudra, because he's intelligent. So he could do the duty of a sudra very expertly. And yeah, intelligence, I mean, like becoming a carpenter. He puts his mind to it, but I'm not going to be able to do it. Probably better than all the others who are, you know, like sudra by nature. But then he's not doing his duty. So he's doing the duty of another perfectly, but he's not doing his duty. So he says it's better to do your duty imperfectly than to do somebody else's duty imperfectly. Like, you know, a Brahman may be not such a elevated, scholarly, very erudite, you know, Brahman, but he's going to contribute more to society by doing what he can on this level, then come down to the next level and be like a very intelligent administrator. So that sense is also there, especially that you do your duty perfectly, and better to do your duty imperfectly than somebody else's duty perfectly, because, you know, Arjuna especially wanted to defect and, you know, like that.
At the present moment, since we were not trained from the beginning, it is very difficult to determine our varnas now. So the best way, like Maharaj said, is to attend a bona fide spiritual master. A spiritual master can give us duty according, because he knows he has vision, he can give us duty according to what would be good for us to become perfect in Krishna consciousness. Sometimes it's difficult for some devotees who prefer, according to my nature, I should be engaged in such a service. But if a guru has an emergency and he is requesting a devotee to, like, you have been a pujari for long and he's saying now you should do cooking, he cannot say, no, my nature is to be a pujari. That would become an offense, and that would not help us to progress in Krishna consciousness. So the best way at the present moment, until the Vanasana system is fully established from the beginning, as Maharaj is doing, then we can exactly know what is to be done. But for now, we should act on that bona fide spiritual master. That will save our life.
Yes, backside, one question.
How do we go about Srila Prabhupada's statement that in Kali Yuga everybody is born a sudra? How to prevent that in the future? Or else we're back to square one every generation.
Yes. Yes.
So how do the Yastras should be taught to feed their children and properly?
Yeah.
How to elevate?
How to not remain, especially for our future generations, born as Shudras. Yes.
Yeah, usually, if the parents qualify, then the children have better
yes.
chance to qualify.
Yeah. Well, it's a good question. Srila Prabhupada has, I'm sure we have all heard Srila Prabhupada's mentioning how the children born within our movement, children who are born from devotee parents. So Prabhupada meant, from devotee qualified parents those who are actually following the various samskaras, beginning from the Garbhadhana samskara. Children who are born from such births, they're not ordinary children, isn't it? So that is very much part of our duties and responsibility, both those who are grihasthas, everyone within the system of varnasrama, the sannyasis have to preach nicely, have to explain these points nicely. People have to take up their various duties and responsibilities within both the varnas and asramas seriously. And then the more we do that, then the purification will take place, and we will gradually be getting children, because that has to happen. That actually is happening right now, although maybe not so obvious. No, what I'm saying is that, yeah, that although we are in the Kali Yuga, Lord Chaitanya's advent or coming is to actually introduce a golden era, isn't it? Is to introduce Satya Yuga, the golden period of 10,000 years. So we are still in the beginning, at the beginning stage of this 10,000 year period. And this means that gradually, as we take up the instructions given to us by Srila Prabhupada and the previous acharyas, we will become instruments in helping manifest this golden era to materialize. And that means that, you know, the same way that we heard the other day in Satya Yuga, people, they are very elevated, isn't it? They are liberated souls. So, I mean, it's not that tomorrow our children are going to be immediately liberated, but it is going in that direction. The process, the purification is taking place, and when the prediction is there that the golden period of Satya Yuga will become manifest, it means that the individuals in due course of time who will be living in this period, they will be very highly elevated spiritually. So therefore, the time will come when within this 10,000 year period, people will not be born a Shudra. Because actually, it is like, you know, a parenthesis within Kali Yuga, that there is this particular period which is not considered as Kali Yuga. That's why this Kali Yuga, as we have heard before, is glorified by the demigods as being so auspicious. And they are praying actually to be born, to take birth. I would think especially during this 10,000 year period, you know, where it will become very, very beneficial, very auspicious to be born in Vaishnava families who are practicing, who have been practicing for generations. And so that change will take place. How quickly it will take place, when exactly it will take place, we should understand that the process has already begun from the advent of Lord Chaitanya, and especially it's taking on different dimensions. It is presently taking on a very major dimension since Srila Prabhupada has brought out of India this knowledge, the movement of Lord Chaitanya. And responsibility falls upon each and every one of us to actually serve as instruments to help this whole prediction become one day a reality.
I have seen born in Africa, all the children born in ISKCON. And I've also seen here in India, the Gurukul also in Vrindavan. The children born here are not encouraged. It is not that what the children we have now, golden age is going to come, what we are experiencing. Therefore, it is our responsibility, especially for those who are householders now, to start Banarsan right from the beginning of their married life, they are preparing to get children. That is the beginning of Banarsan. This will begin from there. And also is the duty of all the leaders, the teachers, sannyasis, gurus are traveling, to start introducing this tradition, this Varnashram, like this seventh canto we are reading now. If we start preaching them seriously and educate our devotees to properly follow these things, and then produce the good quality children who are going to implement this Varnashram in the proper term of the words, and then we can have good children that are going to carry on this message. Not that we should just be expecting the golden age to come, but the children we are giving birth to them without the foundation. It's our responsibility, it's our duty for all of us who are having this knowledge to promote it. Then we can have that age we are looking for, or the Varnashram tradition we are looking for. It depends on the effort of all of us.
I was living in Los Angeles about in 1989. I went to Los Angeles to help Paddy Atch America, and I was observing some gurukulis with surfboards and shorts jumping into the back of a convertible car going to the beach. And I was thinking to myself, you know, these were gurukulis. What happened? And I was realizing how, because we haven't developed the Varnashram side of our society, Iskcon society, and also because, as I'd mentioned in the very first presentation, how the gurukulas were really not developed the way they could have been, they should have been. Many of the gurukulas, for instance, like one we had was in Dallas, in the city. You know, the influences are so strong, and it's only if you can remove the kids completely, like the gurukula here is so removed from all influences, that, so all of these different factors, each little factor, the need to develop Varnashram in our communities, to have the schools out in the countryside, away from the influences. We had Lakshmimani Mataji came to us the other day, and she was telling us how she was teaching for 22 years. And recently it was almost, she gave up teaching because all the kids had cell phones. And in the middle of the night they'd be talking to their friends outside, and she just had no way of controlling it all because it was just uncontrollable because the influence was just invasive. So it just marks the point, it's so important to develop the traditional societies in such a way with the culture, etc., so that there is no interest in outside things, and that they, you know, that then they can actually develop in a very nice way. Yes, one more question.
It's very nice to remember how Srila Prabhupada wanted the Grihasthas to go and live on the farm and have as many children as they wanted. And to grow their food,
yes,
their clothing, and inspect their children. But unless the parents are themselves living in a rural situation, how are the children going to go back to it?
Yes.
Like our first generation, you know, is like it's an experiment. Will they go back if the situation was there, or is it too late? Because if we miss out one more generation, then it will be we're losing too much gap. So, yesterday, it's an emergency and it should be done as soon as possible.
Yes.
And invite them. Please come, whatever situation you are.
And a good point you're making, Prabhu, that Prabhupada said, as many children as you want.
Yes.
And nowadays, having children, it's like a whole calculated thing, you know? I think I can afford 2, maybe 3. No, because it's like a huge economic pressure of so many kinds. It's like, wow, when I send my third kid to college, that's it, and I'm not sponsoring anymore, you know. But if you have food, you know, if you have the Varnashram in place, there's plenty of food, and the Gurukulas are in place and for the different Varnas, whatever qualities, if you're sent as a Vaishya or a Brahman or whatever, there's food for everybody. It's not an anxiety to have children. And naturally that will strengthen them, that will turn in turns into extended families, because you have so many sons, and then your brothers and their brothers will have so that, you know, the whole thing is it becomes like very solid if we train them. They all become like soldiers from birth of Lord Chaitanya's army. But if we don't have food, this will never manifest to that extent. It's always going to be, people will calculate how many children they can have according to their wallet. You know?
Another aspect of that is that we are talking today about the what, according to my vision, is that the second pillar of Varna Aram. Because the first pillar of Varna Aram is to unite the devotees. And that is about our farm, our land distribution. And we do have to the disposal of the devotees 100, 200, 300 plots of land where they can put their house, where they can grow their food, where they can come in for free. And then you can automatically make a village. If you make a village, all the rest is coming. But we are talking today about the second step, that is the education. No? Then the education, and then there is some division in the education. About the children, you said, no? It's true, no? That when one live in the city, one calculate a lot. How many children? One, two, because if I have three children already, I need another car, because you cannot
have a bigger house
because you only have two rooms, then, no? But before, another time, when the people have a plot of land, you grow, you have three, four, five, that means to grow a little more vegetables, no? And put another, a few trees more, no? Some more trees, or to have a one more.
And also, when they become 7 or 8 years old, they no longer live in your house, they live in the Guruji.
Actually, not so long ago, I'll just give you a personal experience. I mean, I come from a French Canadian family. From my mother's side, both my mother's side and father's side, I mean, you know, that goes back, I suppose, 50, 60 years. They both had like 16 children. 1-6. Not 6-0. 16. So, isn't it? Yeah. No. And like, I've been spending some time in Cambodia. Very interesting, because we are interacting with some students who have all come actually from the villages. So there are 15 students were doing some English, conversational English classes. So I was curious to know a little bit about their background, so I wrote one small questionnaire. You know, how many brothers and sisters do you have at home? They all have like, you know, 5, 7, 8, you know, brothers and sisters. And I asked also, how many cows do you have at home? All of them, without an exception, have between 4 and 8 cows at home. I mean, they're from the village. But they're, you know, now they are becoming modernized, and naturally they're selling away their land, selling away their cows, in order to get an education. See, that's the whole, you know, irony and the whole sad thing about the process of deviating. It's a mass deviation. Yes. You know, we've deviated from the principles of Dharma. That's what actually is taking place. And we as devotees need to be very conscientious of this and need to understand that the only way to again follow the principles of Dharma is to really understand what those principles of Dharma are, as we explained the other day, both on the Bhagavad Dharma level and on the Varnashrama level, which means lamb and cows, coming back to the same theme that we were discussing. So this morning we have covered the theme of education, dealing in a general way with both formal and non-formal education. Just for, I'll just finish on this point here. We've used the terms, I just want to clarify or specify a little more clearly how formal education is generally reserved, or means that kind of education which traditionally is found in the Gurukul, where one studies for many years. whereas non-formal education is especially for apprenticeship or vocational training, which generally would not require that many years, less than formal education. And informal education, just so that we understand, you know, we have the same definition, although it could vary from one individual to another, but informal education is that kind of knowledge that we all pick up during the day by interacting with individuals or by reading some book, or it's kind of like in an informal way we become educated by our different experiences or interactions. So today we have two sessions left. One of them, which is coming up right now, will be dealing especially with non-formal education. And the later portion of our seminar today, which will be after lunch, is going to deal with formal education with Preeti Vardhana Prabhu, the director of the Gurukula, here in Mayapur, coming and giving a presentation. So I believe we're, I think so, right? Because we have that much time. And so can you, as the MC?
Okay, so now this is our the practical slot of the day, as we've been, seems to have been designed quite nicely, that we get some philosophy and et cetera, and then we get a practical slot. So Madhava Prabhu is going to come and give us our dose of practical, hands-on, how to develop Varnashram communities.
Since we're talking about families and how to manage big families and how to raise the next generation, I can start off with some technologies for that, rural technologies for that. First, from Ayurveda, how to raise children with a better consciousness, as Prabhuji was trying to say. There are rural technologies for that. The Ayurveda says that the prakriti, the nature, I mean, what do you say, physical prakriti of the child, the kapha, pitta, or vata, comes from the parents, 50% for the mother, 50% from the father. And that is determined at the time of receiving the child. So, therefore, the first sanskar, Gavadhan sanskar, is very properly planned, and they have to execute vratas and keep themselves in a very nice condition so that they don't get any doshas. They don't develop any vata dosh or pitta dosh or kapha dosh in their bodies. And if you don't develop those doshas, then the child who comes also does not get that kind of doshas in his body. And if you don't have those doshas in the body, then you're in a much better situation to deal with the world and you're not sick. Actually, if one is, one, a child is, I mean, we give a child a kapha dosh, that means the whole life we have to deal with the kapha of the child. So these are basic technologies which Srila Prabhupada has given us. Okay. Doshas, basically according to Ayurveda, there are three basic constituents of the body. Kapha, pitta, and vata. Kapha is mucus, bile is pitta, and vata is air. So these three constituents actually determine the way a person functions, the way a man thinks, a way a person will behave in the world, things like that. So if we have given them kapha dosha, means cough and phlegm, and even up to the extent of asthma and different diseases like that. So if a child is not, the parents are careful that we have to bring a child without these diseases. So he plans, they plan it like that. That's for the purpose of the selecting a proper date and performing proper rituals, keeping their bodies, keeping vratas, or eating the proper kind of food. And therefore, when the child comes, they don't give 50% of the trouble. He doesn't get a trouble. He grows up with much better constitution, which is more conducive for him to understand knowledge and Vedic system, and he's one ahead in the start. So that's how the parents can give a start to the children. That's the first part. Second part is, in Vedic culture, I'm coming right back to the design aspect of houses. One first thing about housing in Vedic culture is that today's housing has a lot of two aspects to housing. One is private spaces and common spaces. In Vedic houses, you have much more of common space rather than a lot of private space. Whereas today's world, we try to create a lot of private space for each other, or for each one of us, because of that, the technology that is available. Like, for example, electricity gives you the luxury of having a lot of private space in every house, whereas previously we had more common spaces. And this private space also separates you. You know, your computer, your TV, your light, and your bulb, and your desk, and your everything separates you from the rest of the family. Therefore, there is no gelling in with one another. The family is all divided. But when there is a lot of common space, if you come to different old houses in different parts of India, you will see that the houses had more common space, like verandas or open courtyards. Of course, there was a private space for the janani, you know, or the ladies. They had their private space, but they also had their own common spaces. So even if there was a big family, you didn't really have to build more, because the common spaces kind of made up for that. Private space was only allowed possibly for the head of the family. Rest of them, and that is what community life meant, that you learn how to live with everyone. So this is a concept of design in Vedic housing. So that's one aspect of designing with houses, and you don't really need to build up so much. Second thing about housing today, actually I would like to thank Sambha Prabhu for introducing me to mud way back in 1994. Thank you.
What?
Introduced me to mud. Mud housing. He was actually the one who introduced me to mud housing, and today we have mud houses in which we live, and we are very happy living in them. First and foremost, I think we were together when we started building up there in BEV, right?
Yeah.
So we were building it. I remember the cost that was there in building those houses. Just tremendous. You had to cart everything up, probably 60 kilometers, 70 kilometers. The cost of transporting was far more than what you spent actually building, the amount of space that you had to build. So the transport costs were far more than the stones and the cement and the rods and everything and the wood that you carted up there to build. And forget about the problems of transporting and unloading and the trucks getting stuck. So one good thing about what Srila Prabhupada said to Hari Sori Prabhu, when Hari Sori Prabhu wrote a letter to him, he said, build your houses locally, from locally available materials. Prabhupada knew exactly what to do. And therefore, immediately the cost comes down. For example, the house that we built, we built it with mud and stone, which is available in the area. And a 3,000 square foot of house costed us less than 100 rupees a square foot. So, and it is easily maintainable. And the main cost was the wood. The mud costs nothing, practically. So that is the second aspect of Vedic technologies, that you can use local materials, you just have to learn how to use them. Now let's talk about building in mud. How do you understand how to build in mud? I think he will be more better to explain. He's got years and years of training. But a very simple way is that your mud needs about 15 to 20% clay and 85% sand. And a lot of straw in it. In India, they have developed a whole lot of understanding of what kind of straw you need to use. The most commonly used is the rice straw, but actually that is not the best straw to be used for making houses. The best straw to make, you need to put straw into your mud to give it what you call tensile strength. Yeah, the tensile strength to your mud. The tensile strength means to hold it together, and it doesn't disintegrate so easily. So the more of, not too much also, but you have to put a good amount of straw into your mud to build your houses. In building mud houses, there are basically two or three types. One is which you use, you combine the mud, water, straw, and in India they also use the rice husk. What do you call this here? I don't know. The rice husk is also used. The rice husk also makes your mud almost like concrete. It becomes very hard. It gives it very good strength. So when you combine all of these things, just in case people are interested, there are several good books on it. The one of the best books that I've seen is this one. Even though it is, some basics are very good, and even though they keep using a lot of concrete in it, and then they use a lot of other more than synthetic materials, but still, it's a good basis, good thing to start with. But in India, we have hundreds and thousands of artisans and men who know to build mud houses much better than them. But still, I mean, they're on the losing side because the technology is going away. People don't prefer them. Now, once you build the mud, the way to test your mud, whether it can be built directly with the mud which is available in your area, is to put it into a frame, into some square frame. There are other ways of testing, which is mentioned in this book also. Some ring tests and different tests are mentioned in this book. The way we test the mud is we put it into a frame, square frame, put the mud into it, after mixing it properly with water. There should not be too much water also, and not too little either. If there's too much of water, then it'll just kind of sag down. It'll just kind of open up. And if you have too little water, then it gets too sticky. So you have to have the right kind of measure of water, and you put it into this box and let it dry in the shade for 15 days. Once you dry it in the shade for 15 days, then lift it above your head and throw it down. If it disintegrates, it's useless. That means there's too much sand. If it breaks into two, it is good, useful. If some corner breaks, it's still pretty good. If it doesn't break at all, it's the best.
Which straw then?
The best straw in India that they say is, I know, in Ekadashis we use this varai, what do you call it, samak or varai?
Samarai.
Samarai, we call it. The straw of that is the best for making mud blocks or mud houses. I don't know. I'm talking about in India. You can grow practically in every part of India. It's a millet. Wheat. I don't think it's very good. Wheat is not very good. It's a very weak straw. Better than that is rice or just normal grass that grows. Just have to see that it has its strength.
You cut it by pieces of how long?
Depends on what you want to do with it. If you're going to build a cob house, you don't need to. You can practically use it like that. If you're going to make mud blocks, you need to cut them in small pieces. And if you, there are three types of basically houses. If you can make bricks, sun-dried bricks, don't burn them, because burning is another aspect of it. It is more expensive, and also you need to have the right kind of clay and sand. Then only you can make a normal, what do you call it, burnt brick. But other bricks cannot, these mud block bricks will not work in that kind of case. They won't, they'll disintegrate after some time. So that's one aspect of mud houses. First is you make frames and you make bricks out of them, and then sun dry them in the shade, turn them after 4 days, and then use them for making mud houses. I think we showed some part of it yesterday. So we'll see it later, I think, some part of it. Next is to make adobe house, right? Cob houses. Cob is then you just make your mud mortar, and then you put it into the place, have a layer foundation, and on top of it start piling them in the layers of 2 to 3 feet every day. And gradually dry them, preferably in the shade. Shade drying is better because sun drying causes cracks in your what do you call it, in your clay.
So, if I understand, you say you just pile up the mud
Yeah, I mean, I can't, I don't want to go into technical aspects. The bottom has to be broader and smaller at the top. Yeah, just keep piling 3 to 4 feet every day, or every 3-4 days.
But.
Yeah, but with your hand. You just dump it down. The third way is rammed earth. That is the strongest mud house I have seen and experienced and lived in rammed earth houses, which are 300 to 400 years old. They remain as it is. Ekachakra, rammed earth. Rammed earth is that you have planks, two planks, and you put it around
wooden
planks, and in the middle of your wooden planks, then you make this mud mortar and you ram it in with a, what do you call it?
Compressor.
Ram, yeah. You ram.
Feet also?
Yeah, also with feet. And you do about 3 to 4 feet every day, or 2 feet a day, and let it dry for 2 or 3 days, and then again have to do the whole thing again.
You move the wood out.
Yeah.
You have a kind of cross that sits on top of the wooden stove, and there's a new piece of wood.
The planks that you use on the base, you put a little kind of strut between them, and you move it up, and you sit on top of the wall you just made, and then you pour in more mud. And then when that's dry, you move it up again. And so you see the kind of ridges in the house as they get built up. And then you plaster it afterwards.
The walls are very smooth, very strong. A little problem with the doors and windows. You have to put lintels down. You can also put arches. That's also good. Rammed earth houses, the only thing is that some people don't like it because it's not too artistic. It's just straight. But it's very strong. And it's sometimes even rodents can't get through it, whereas other things rodents can get through it. But rammed earth is normally not the best. But one aspect about rammed earth houses is that you need to do the whole house one level on one day. So that's where you need an intense lot of manpower immediately on that particular day. You got to do the whole thing in one day, because if you leave it, if you leave half of it, then you even a place for cracks and weakenings. So that's one thing that we were about to ram the houses, but we didn't do it because labor intensive. You've got to do, like, in 3 days, you've got to have 20, 25, 18, 20 people at one day doing the house. No, you have to do it not when it's completely dry. You have to be, like, semi-dry, 4 days, 3 days, 4 days. It should be still a little wet. When you remove it, it should be, because why I'm saying why you need this is very simple. Because when you ram it from the top, the lower shank should not just kind of bulge out. If it is too wet, then it will bulge out. Right? When the weight comes in something wet, it should bulge out. So you don't have to bulge it out. So you've got to keep it there. So it dries about 4 days, it's hard enough, then you can receive another layer, it will not bulge out. And if you give a lot of weight to it, then also it will bulge out. So you have to be careful about how much weight you have to give. Basically about this much a day.
We require a ramming ramen.
He taught me. Here he is.
He's my badass. Also the straw, I have heard in some that, they had some recipe where they cut the straw and then they mix it, they leave it in the water for some time. And
Depends kind of what kind of straws you're using. Depends on which kind of straw. If it's too hard, maybe they use it. Nothing, as you mentioned
it. Like they turn it into some kind of a paste, they try to break it down to the fiber.
Different traditions.
Yeah, like for example, if you use agave, it's like a cactus.
Okay, okay.
If you use that agave cactus, big thick leaves, if you use that you have to rot it down and bring the fibers up. Okay, it's very good fiber, but getting agave is a problem, but in certain areas where agave is very easily available, it's good. Another thing about mud is that if you keep it overnight, it becomes more sticky. If you can keep it for 3 days, it becomes even more sticky. In fact, sometimes it's so sticky that you can't use it, easily. So you have to be careful how many days you keep it. If you can keep it for 2 to 3 days, very good with mud. So this is about mud houses. It can take a lot of weight. You can increase the width of the walls, 15 inches to 2 feet and 3 feet, whatever you want. And the thicker it is, the more cooler it is. You don't need an AC, you don't need fans. they're naturally cool, and it's temperature controlled. In the summer it can be cool, in the winter it can be warm. Yeah, coming to the roof. See, mud structures and wood should not touch exactly. There should be some stone in between. If you don't put stone, a bamboo also, you shouldn't put stone, you should put some stone, because mud or bamboo, they tend to kind of, during winds or some kind of movements, tend to kind of move, and that slowly breaks your edges. So you need to have in between some stone on which the wood,
on the last part,
on which it rests. Okay. Bamboo is also good enough, but you have to be careful how long you use it, because bamboo, if you don't season it, it's got a life for 3 to 4 years, but it's very good if you can use it well. The seasoned bamboo, it can even last up to 60 years to 70 years, bamboo. Straw houses, I have bad experience. I wouldn't suggest it to anyone right now. When I come up with something better, maybe you have some better experience. Number one, it's very expensive if you don't have your own straw. And even if you have your own straw, sometimes when the first rains come, it starts leaking. So, like our lives are things, a lot of books and papers, and sometimes when the first rains come, then you have to sit up the whole night and wait for the grass to actually expand, become thick and expand, and then it doesn't. Then it's very nice. Actually, it's better than any other roof, provided it doesn't leak inside. So I've heard in places in Indonesia they use kusha. And also I heard traditionally that they have done, Sri Lakshman Ji built a hut for Sri Ramachandra using kusha grass. I don't know if someone knows more about it than they can do. Okay, now I have something more practical. In the mixture? Normally we use it for plastering. Normally not used for plastering.
And urine, I think you were telling me a few years ago that you found out that by incorporating urine in the mix, which villagers were not doing, you found out that you got rid of your termite and whatever.
Yeah, that's on the plaster. Plastering, yeah.
Yeah. I've heard that when you start this plastering, you have to do it every day. That's what the people are doing. You know, when you start with this, like, cow dung, slurry, floor cleaning, that has to be a daily practice, and that's what
you initially, when you make the floor, initially when you make a mud floor, let's talk about mud floors also. Okay, I'll talk about something more important, is that mud houses, one of the biggest enemies of mud house is rain or moisture. It should not touch the moisture, should not come up the walls. So you need to put the foundation, and above the foundation, preferably a dry foundation with just stones, and which has a drainage. The foundation could also be drained out if possible, otherwise you have a curtain around it to drain out the water, and build a stem wall above it, at least some portion above it, and make sure your roof is so designed that you don't get any water splashing on
sideways. So what about in a place like BED, we have like horizontal rain?
I get better, more rains than you do. You get 7 meters in 3 months, 4 months. 7 meters of rainfall in 4 months.
And would you have windy rain?
We get 45 to 55 kilometers per hour rain. The rain comes at that speed.
So how do you deal with it not getting the rain on the side?
We have grass. You use grass to cover them up. Cover the walls during the rainy season. It's called jharpi. I think we showed it yesterday. We show it again if possible. Anyway, now this is about rural technology again. This is the Indian cashew. You make first-class paint or wood protectors with this. Anyone can take a look. Anyone else? These are not cashews, these are called bibba.
Have to be chewed.
Yeah, please don't chew it. Don't chew, this has got...
Keep away from children.
Yes. there's a way to do it also. He put it into into a mud pot, fill it up, put a cover, turn it over, and put another mud pot into the ground. And this mud pot, which is exposed to the top, you cover it up with all kinds of things that will burn it. And then you start a fire, maybe at night. And then when it gets heated up, this seed, the shell of this seed, will give out oil. This is one of the best things that you can use for wood. It makes it rainproof, waterproof,
termite proof.
But of course, first thing is your wood has to be mature.
What the plan of this story? Something that takes 25 years to grow, or is it
About 7 to 10 years? Yes, 7 to 10 years. I have not been able to germinate the seed so far. It's normally widely germinated. I haven't got the technology as yet to germinate the seed. Kolhapur? Yes, Bibba is very popular. And it's like cashew. It's the Indian cashew. Inside it is the kernel, which is the cashew.
And what about the regular cashew? Because they use that kind of cashew oil also for beans and stuff in villages, right?
Yes.
It's mixed with petroleum products most of the time, no? Like
this is the best. That is second grade. Mature wood? Actually, not any kind of wood can be used for construction. Only hard wood can be used for construction. And mature wood means which has gone beyond a particular amount of years. Each different variety has different kinds. 7 to 10 years is normally the time of maturity of most wood. If you use wood which is less than that, you're asking for shagging, or it'll come down, or it'll bend, or it'll have borers, different things like that. And some of the trees, we built our house mainly with Arjuna trees. Arjuna, those black Arjuna trees. So. No. If it's a mature wood, you don't need to season. It's got a life of 800, 900, 1,000 years, as long as there's no water touching it. It can last even longer.
It
needs to be grown enough.
Oh, grown enough.
So basically, keep your walls dry from the rain, especially. Keep it away from, protect the walls. Roof should be good. Roofing challenges are there. Not roofing challenges are there. If you have a tile roof, normal tile roof, the inclination is about 4 inches per foot. You've got to have an inclination of the slant. Yeah, the slope is 4 inches per foot. So you go like that. If you're building a straw house, you need to have an inclination of whatever is the height of your side wall, the middle wall has to be double.
What about thickness and how high or slow
is mud houses?
Yeah.
Mud houses, basically, it depends on how much load you're going to put on the wall. If it's going to have the whole wooden roof on top of it, then you've got to be really careful with the weight that you're going to take. At least 15 inches if you're going to have wooden. If you're using bamboo, also 15, because it also not only takes the weight of the roof and the tiles, it also takes the weight of the wind and the rain that hits it. Yeah, two stories is also possible, but you have to have wood in between. Wood or bamboo or some kind of thing which will have it. Nowadays, because the wood is becoming very scarce, different people are coming up with different technologies like vaults and domes and things like that. We are trying to experiment with vaults and domes. We have not started. We did one. We did our altar, but as a vault, only in mud. Yes, Prabhu. Stone buildings? You have to be careful with stone buildings in two cases, even with carved sun-dried bricks. If you're in a seismic zone, earthquake-prone zone, make sure, number one, that you don't have very tall buildings in mud, in stone. In Latur, in Maharashtra, 40,000 people were killed because they were basically living in stone houses. So because the stones fell and people died in it. Now the reason why they died is asphyxia. The mud and things that caused the kind of dust in kind of they died of suffocation. So if you have stone, it's good to build the outer walls with stone and the inner wall maybe with mud. But you, if it's seismic free, yeah. But if it's not seismic, it's okay. If not, it's a seismic zone. Earthquake-prone zones? Okay. And wood.
It's a thing of local materials. It's very hot stone. Then you know you're going to live somewhere, so they'll use it. But they have methods of binding it together with lime mortar or.
Even lime mortar is not seismic, but if you can, what you do here. Maybe wood can be used in between. Right. That keeps it very stable.
What about this? I heard that there's a technology where it's a cooked clay house using like a big clay pot.
That's something new, yeah.
Yeah, Mark Hill did that.
That's new.
He made a mud house and he filled it with pots.
Yeah.
And he fired the whole house. He also made tiles. And he fired the whole house like a kiln. He made the house like a kiln. Fired the whole thing. And then he took out all the tiles for his roof and then he sold some of the pots to help offset the cost of the firewood. And the whole house was a one solid baked unit. But that's a kind of, and he was a potter, he knew what he was doing. It's not something that everyone could do.
It is very, firewood is very expensive today. Yes, Matt.
I was born in the village. And all of our buildings. So we came to the city. They all bought houses. I have a very good experience in building. I was part of the builds, bought houses. It doesn't require much of the technologies that you are introducing here. Very simple and very, very strong. And another private day, his father, from his village, they have solid buildings. The boat house. Still is using even before it was burnt. Very solid and strong. Maybe we should introduce that in the village. For experience in boat houses. Very simple. Our mode, we best use only the mode. Yes. But for if you are going to use blocks or you are going to build directly without blocks, use mode. Like you said, 3 days. Two layers. 2 days, 3 layers. They come to the standard building.
What we are talking about is which was used very commonly all over just a few decades ago. But today we are having to talk about it because we've lost it.
What about the temperature?
Inside the house? How to take care of the.
In the sense that for colder countries,
yes.
The ingredients required should be something different for hotter countries.
Yeah, that is all mentioned here. They give examples of cold places and hot places.
Yes.
In England,
they did.
Europe, all India, Africa.
In Ukraine, he was telling me, Danish one, that it's mostly about houses that are still in the very interior villages.
Why we're giving this session is basically because we have a cement paradigm today. You know, we have a concrete and a cement paradigm and we can't get out of it. And we think anything other than a cement and a concrete paradigm is going to be bad. So we have to understand that mud houses are not bad. They're very nice and wonderful to live in.
And they're actually very insulating. No?
Yeah.
Like, so they insulate from the heat, they also insulate from the cold.
And one more thing I will talk about concrete is that concrete will last a maximum, made of the best quality, best way, to give a lifespan of 100 years, right?
Yeah, in general they're about 70 years because no one really puts attention to.
Yeah, so 70 years.
100 years, but 70 years, 50 years. 50. Even, you know, in Calcutta, Mumbai, they fall down 12, 20 years, or 10 years, you know, depends on how careful you are.
So cement will not last. Cement houses, cement binding force goes on reducing, but mud doesn't. It just remains like that.
It can be reused.
Yeah, it can be reused. It can be reused. Everything can be reused of your mud house.
About a month ago, I was in Italy, and they took me to see the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And I said, well, that's nothing special. You can't come to the Sermon Hill.
There's a time you put your eye on the wall and you see the curve.
Yeah, so if you're building
mud
house, I would say 15 inches is minimum you should keep, 15 inch.
Minimum
15 inch is good. Specifically with load-bearing walls. Load-bearing walls can be even thicker, 17 to 20 inches also. Yes, Prabhu.
I thought actually to buy one house here in Mayapur. So after hearing what you say, I thought that I should be is it possible here with good architect Mart, with the flat, it will be after the flat comes, it will be all
I can tell you after, we're doing a lot of work here on that, and I can give you all those details. This is a little unique because this is a floodplain,
yeah.
And floods, you can flood up to, like, the last 2 years they've seen these floods each year, so it's a unique place, which is not, generally people don't build in the floodplain, because this is the dam we're building here. So this is a unique place, and things can be done,
Okay. Huh? Okay, so shall we move on to something else? Shall we move to something else? Shall we move on to agricultural implements? Okay. India and a lot of the countries have a rich heritage of agricultural implements. And plenty of them we're going to lose out in the next few years. Yeah. We're going to lose a lot of these technologies, agricultural technologies, which are gone. Here what you see is, I'm going to show you, can you see the two men with T-shirts? One is a red and one is a stripe. And in between that, there's an old man right in the middle there. Can you see him holding some stick in the middle?
Yeah.
He is 65 years old. And he's the last man in about four districts that we kind of went around looking for a man who knows how to make, an oil pressing, coal oil pressing bullock driven oil pressing machine. It's a traditional, it's called a ghani, oil ghani. So this man is the last man who has an idea how to build a stone ghani. He actually helped his uncle 40 or 45 or 50 years ago. Now he's 65 years old. And we found him somehow. He said, I think I might be able to do it. I've seen my uncle do it. I helped him to do it. But I've never done one after that. And we tried to get him in 4 months, he didn't come because he was afraid that he didn't know how to do it, he'd spoil the whole thing. So finally we kind of coaxed him, even if you do a failure, no problem, just come and try it. And finally he came and he set this up. And with our devotees, that's a devotee, these are all devotee masons. So they kind of learned the whole thing and then they started building that. Now let me go back to oil in agriculture and agriculture technology. Yesterday we saw what Prabhupada said about vegetable oils. Actually, Ayurveda mentions only two kinds of oils to be used for cooking. And other than ghee is the best. The next best after that is sesame oil, or til oil. And after that is kusba, or kusumba, or saf flour. These are the only three things that are being told in Shastras to be used for cooking. Anything else that you use, which is the Shastras consider all of those things as vegetables, including peanut. There's mention of peanut in Ayurveda and it's considered a vegetable. Any vegetable oils used for cooking or for human consumption causes infertility.
Even this coconut oil is not considered.
I have to find out more about coconut. I haven't tried. I mean, we've been trying about peanut because
we are
in peanut area. So basically, we've been looking for peanut and other things that grow in that area.
So till and safflower or karde, right? You call Marathi karde? Yes, Prabhu.
I heard also olive oil, but they should not be cooked. It should be taken raw.
Okay. So that's not, I mean, maybe that's not the tradition that we have to bring about.
That's,
yes. So olive oil should not be cooked.
Then we talk about the Ekadashi, peanut oil is kind of accepted or modified for cooking.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Whether
let's first talk about what you should eat on Ekadashi when we talk about the oil. Because we're not supposed to eat on Ekadashi anyway. So that's it.
No, you said that vegetable oil is not to be eaten.
Yeah.
Ghee?
No. Right. Ghee is expressed.
It's called intuitive, but you become.
Anyway, I think
yes.
You can cook
with ghee. Okay. So that's why Prabhupada said harmful vegetable oils in yesterday's essay. He was very careful. He knew everything. So we have a wonderful spiritual master who has given us everything in his books. So now come to the other point of extracting oil. In this process of extracting oil using the bulls, one is it that you get excellent food for the cows and the bulls by doing this. It's like chocolate for them, the oil cakes.
Which oil you are extracting?
We first started with peanut oil, then we went to safflower. Now we have to find out the technology for til or gingerly oil or sesame oil. Now, let me tell you this thing. Now, what is done is, can you go back to that stone ghani? For the first one, yeah. Now, this is the oldest technology. Oldest oil ghani technology known in India. I don't think there is anything older than this. Now, this requires, I will show you later the whole thing, how it builds up into a big thing. Can you go to that one? Can you find that one with the whole thing? Is it in this one? I don't know. Oh, yeah, that's what I was wanting them to show you. Okay, keep it at this. Keep it at this. Now, this is a basic technology that is used for doing this. Can you take that, your cursor, and show that stick in the middle? Yeah, that is the main thing that crushes your oil. And it goes inside that structure. Inside the structure, there is a kind of a conical-shaped wooden structure inside, in which you put in your seeds, and then this thing goes around with the bull. Yeah, the bull goes around, and it's a slight inclination. And that inclination actually crushes. So what happens is that it goes inside there, it moves it on slightly, and because there's oil content in your seeds, it practically gets stuck onto the sides. So you've got to keep putting water and digging it the paste out again and again. And you've got to do it very fast. It takes about 3 to 4 hours to do 1 quintal of oil seeds, which from 100 kilos. From different, coconut will give you about 55 liters. Sorry? Per quintal.
What is a quintal?
100 kilos. Sorry, I'm a villager. other oils give, depending on 30%, 30-35 peanuts, different varieties of peanuts are also there, about, I think, 4 or 5 varieties.
This is different than the first gram you showed us.
Right? Yeah, that is stone. This is steel body. This is, first there was a stone, then they moved to wooden ones, then they moved to steel ones, then they moved to electric ones. So this is how it progressed.
But the stone one, how do you get the oil out? Is there a drain or anything?
No, this one has a drain in it. Now, I'll just come to the grinding of it, I mean the taking out the oil, extraction. The modern days, what they do is that they, when they use the pressing system, they pump steam into it. It makes it very hot. And when it's steamed, when you crush the thing, you get more oil. You get 2 to 3 liters extra oil per 100 kilos. But the problem is that the oil, when it goes into your body, your body temperature is between 37-38 degrees. If you're extracting oil at a higher temperature, it goes into your body and becomes like wax.
It becomes what?
Wax. Becomes like wax. Because it's hard. It doesn't melt in your body.
Okay, when you extract it at the higher temperature. Can you get
it? Yeah, okay, yeah, yeah.
Because it remains, it sticks in your body, anything which is low temperature. So your body temperature cannot actually take that. So the Vedic system already had it. And this, in this thing, the oil is extracted between 30 to 40 degrees centigrade.
Cold pressed,
yes. So this is the best oil. And the heart surgeons of late are blaming all the heart problems, most of the heart problems, on the oil. Sorry? They're blaming all the heart problems on the oil, cholesterol. And they're suggesting that go back to this. In fact, some of them are telling don't even take things like sunflower oil and other oils. Some people say sunflower oil is like wax itself. It doesn't do anything. Yes?
Kushpa is what I was
confused to say. Sap flower, S-A-F. S-A-F. F-L. In the market you get it. In the, yes. In the market you get it in the name of Safola.
I
know, it's a small shrub kind of the thing. Thorns. Very difficult to harvest because it has a lot of thorns.
How it takes care of cholesterol problem?
One thing is that when you put steam to crush your seeds, that means you're increasing the temperature. Okay, therefore you're taking out oil in it, which actually melts at a higher temperature. So when you take out something which is in a higher temperature, and you keep it there, but when you take it in, your body temperature is 37 to 40 degrees within that. So your system will not be able to digest it. So it remains within and goes within your system and causes cholesterol, or whatever you call it. They call it saturated fats, polyunsaturated fats, I don't know, whatever. Dr. Sal. So this is about oil, honey. There's a lot more to talk about this. We will try to show you the... this is the how you do it. You sit down, one person sits at the back, you put some weight and goes around like this. Yes.
It's fun.
Yeah. There are a lot of other things. Actually, when you do this and everyone comes around and they sit around, they hang around, they talk.
And the bull must like it because, you know, after they're getting some cake.
Yes, yes. Yes, yes.
Do they actually, after some time, realize that when they do that, they're getting the cakes?
Yeah, they smell it. They're doing it, they're smelling it all the time.
He's always trying to get in there.
Well, that's how you keep them going around.
Okay. Yeah, there's the stone. Yes. These are some farm implements. I'm just giving you these ideas. I'm not saying that this is a solution for everything. Every village, every town, every continent, every country has their own tools. I'm just saying that there's a lot of things to be done. We don't need to come to educational institutions and learn about all this engineering and stay within some rooms and learn all this technology. One thing is that when you stay here and you learn all these things, you deal with animals, you get a lot of common sense. Whereas you sit down in classrooms for 25 years, and I learned nothing from there. No common sense, at least. So these things that cannot be learned inside the classrooms. And secondly, you become too weak by staying 25 years inside and not going out in the sun and not doing any hard work. So 25 years later, when you're supposed to do it, you can't go and do it because the sun is too hot. And you're too weak. And so you look for another job inside the house. Yes.
I did a little bit of study of the Amish. The Amish are a group of Christians in America that have been living the same for 500 years. And in recent years, they found that they couldn't get enough land for some of the children. Some of the Amish families, generally speaking, all the children would get land and they work on the farm. But some families, they had to do workshop-type activities. And later on, when they got land, the children of those families that didn't grow up on the land couldn't take to the farm. They couldn't do it. And they found that was very interesting because for hundreds of years, they were all farmers. But then they suddenly discovered that some of the children just couldn't take to it because they hadn't grown up with it. So it's a very, very important part. If you don't grow up having some connection with the land, you won't want to do it when you become an adult, which is what we find with many of our devotees.
You look for another place where you can stay inside with a fan and AC and stay inside and don't go out. And then you need, Huh? Yeah, comfortable. Yeah, because you haven't used your hand, your muscles, your body is not developed like that. So you're afraid of it.
The one thing is that if you do that, you don't get the pain of going out in the rain. You get the pain of diseases from sitting around and not properly metabolizing your food, etc. Eating too much.
Yeah.
Not working enough.
Not digesting.
Yeah.
And then you go to you have a listening of what do you call the doctors and diagnosis and gyms and etc. Okay, we go back into that one. Can you go a little back? Yeah. A little more?
One more.
Okay, let's go to the standing thing. Now this this is an implement. I'm just giving you these because I'm not saying that this is what you should learn or do. We just learned these in the village. We got around, learned how to build all these things. We never went to any courses or anything. But this is basically what we learned from the nearby people. This is a piece of log you use to break up the big clumps to level your land. So you break the big clumps. You have bulls pulling that, and two or three people sit on it, and all the big clumps on your agricultural land gets broken when you plow. After you plow, then you sit on this and you have a good fun time, and everyone runs around and sits on this, and the bulls keep pulling around, and your big mud clumps get broken. And basically, it's a process. It's very important. If you don't have this, it's very difficult to cultivate. Okay, next. Now, this is another interesting thing. This is connected with the hand loom. This is, have you seen around the dhotis? At the end of the dhotis, you have nice designs. My dhoti has some designs. Yeah, this one. Can you see some fine designs on these? On one end of your dhoti, the finished end of your dhotis, you'll see some design. Yeah, those designs are created by these things. No, this is like that room. You've got it the other way. Yeah, you turn it left, I think. Yeah, okay, it's like that. You have to actually put it on top of your looms, and then you get different kinds of designs, especially for saris and borders for shirts or blouses. You get very beautiful designs from them. These are very old, made of wood, and can create so many designs with this. All traditional designs were created with these kind of things. This is very highly specialized kind of thing.
Okay.
This is a stone roller. What do you call it? Roller. The use of this in agriculture is that you use it for crushing jawar. What millet is it called? Pearl millets. Yeah, pearl millets. You use that for crushing pearl millets out of the... Okay, can you go to that house? He's standing. This is the finish that you get with the limestone mortar on your walls. This is a stone building, a laterite stone building, and then we finished it with plastering with limestone cement, which we made on the spot itself, which I'll show you again how we made it. So this is how it finishes. It finishes quite well and stays very long, even in areas where you're close to the ocean. If you're close to the ocean, cement is very bad. Cement does not last. With the salty air coming from the ocean, your cement buildings will be finished very soon. Much, much, much lesser. If you go to Bombay, you'll see all the new buildings are all breaking up. But old ones, BT station, what the other buildings, the courts and all the systems standing. It's more than how many, 200, 300 years? They're still standing. Even I think Sivaji Maharaj is, but he didn't use mortar, I think. The forts which are stone.
Black color.
Lime gold. Okay. So this is what comes out of it. It can get excellent finish. It's not that limestone is anywhere bad, but it's much better. And you can store it. Once you make the limestone, if you keep putting water on the mortar every day, you can store it for 10 years in that way, and then use it after 10 years or so. No problem. Okay, next one. This is about, again, this is the stone ghani. Can you see it now? The whole contraption? Inside that stone, you'll find another conical-shaped wooden structure being made. Inside it goes this thing. And you can see two sides on the top. Can you see that side? Yeah, what happens is as this one goes round and round, the wood inside gets corroded. So once the wood gets corroded, then you turn the honey upside down and you use the bigger side inside now. Until it goes on for another few years, and then it becomes further corroded, then you have another one. So then you use a bigger one then.
So you have two sticks like that, and you can, for your whole life, practically is enough. So you have to get, then you lift the whole thing. This is the whole contraction to lift the whole stick in the middle, the mortar in the middle, and you lift it, then you take, this doesn't have a hole. So you have to take it out with a cup or something. You take out the oil. This is the best oil, and people say it's the sweetest oil from this oil.
But how do you deal with the hygiene? Because, I mean, you cannot completely clean it, and then something that's oily that...
No, you can clean it. You have to, later on, you can take the cakes out, and you can clean it with water. It's very nice. And the oil cakes, actually, when they dry up, they make excellent things. They become very hard, and they actually seal up everything. In fact, they use this oil cakes to even seal up wood before. You know, wood cracks in the wood, they use this to seal it up. Okay? I don't know if you all have anything else in your traditions. I'm sure you can have. Maybe we can see more presentations. This is how you make the limestone mortar. You make your own cement from lime, sand, jaggery, haritaki, and some fibers. Different places, different things are used. Jaggery is it's a constant, most almost everywhere. Some other places they use some of the fruits, and it creates, as the years go by, it becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. This is how we make our own cement on the spot. This is frozen average. Now this is a sewing technique. You can sew three rows at one time using this technique. These are bamboos that you can see the boys holding. And then you can see at the bottom, these are those, like plows, small wooden things with little steel in the front. So after you've plowed your land, then you get this contraption on. And the three bamboos go down. And on that wooden plows things, small plow kind of stuff, there are holes there. So next picture, please.
It just replaces it with the
And then you have the thing on the top. Can you see the round thing? It has to be tied up properly, and there are holes on the top. Go to the next one. See, now they're tying it up. Next. Now that is the part which is the place where they put the grains in. Yeah, this is the whole thing now. Yeah, next. This is how there are three holes in it, and the grains would go into three different directions. This is how they tie it. They have a little ladder and then strings to tie it all up.
What do you sow with that?
Safflower, you can sow rice, you can sow wheat, whatever you want to sow in life. I'll show another picture. I think it is there. Yeah, next picture. It's showing how you do it. And now this is the third one, is that suppose you want to sow some other crop. Suppose you want to sow two rows of a particular crop, and the third row you want to replace it with something else. This is how they do it. Can you see the other boy who's standing there with a piece of bamboo? That is now tied to this one. And so he will block one hole and let the other holes, he'll put grains in the two holes, and the third hole, this is going to go. Third line row, this is going to go. Okay, and now, after you've sown your seeds, and this is how you cover it up. You cover up the land. This is how you level your land up. Okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Can you go back to the same picture? Yeah. Now, this is a weaving technique. What do you call it?
Kappa.
In other places, they call it kolpa. Other names like that. Now, this is used for weeding of rice. If your bulls are very expert, you can have bulls to pull it. And bulls expert means they walk on straight lines, they don't walk on your plants. Very trained bulls, they don't walk into your plants, they will walk just straight along, and you can weed them. The more you do this, the better rice you get. Better quality, much more rice production increases, and this naturally weeds off everything else on the sides. Also makes heaps on the rice rows. So this is
waterless rice. It is without water.
Yeah, it doesn't have standing water. Even with standing water, you can use this. Now, we have two. Other people have six, four, five, like that, depending on how trained their bulls are. They also do it with human beings as well, because you have to be very careful walking in the rows. I'm sure other places have wonderful techniques like this, but I'm just doing it because the things that we need to learn how to do, these are simple things that we need to bring them out. This is a blade used, actually the whole structure is not there. This is a blade used to kind of cut off all the grass and the roots. pull it with the bullock, and then it just cuts off all the grass and the roots and everything, and just cleans the whole land. Now, this is someone who's asking me, how do you remove the husk, de-husk the rice? This is how you de-husk the rice. This is a kind of a grinder which you use, this is made of wood. And you put the rice inside, it showed you now. Yeah, yeah, see, this is the, how you do it. This is made of wood, and the ridges are there. And you put the rice inside, and then it will be husked on the side.
In Bengal,
there's always an example of that. Dheki is after this. Dheki, you need to have the dheki after you de-husk the rice, then there's still a yellow coating on top, which we call polishing. So you need to cut the polish a little bit of the rice, otherwise the rice won't cook. It takes hours and hours to cook. So if you just break the rice into the little cover of the rice, then you can cook it very well. So normally you have to do the dheki after you've done your rice. Right? Am I right? This is the wooden ghani I was telling you about, the rice, the oil ghani. Now this is how you deshell peanuts or kusba or safflower. This has a, this is also like a, what do you call it, chakki, but there's a little gap between that. So you pour in your things and then you turn it around, then all the husk breaks up. Then you have another place, another fan there, you fan the husk and the nuts, they separate up and it falls in one place. Yeah, this is stone. System. This is a traditional thing. I thought if someone has not seen it, I took a picture of this. This is how you churn your butter. How we churn butter. This is, I know what it's called here. In Udupi, famous Udupi Krishna stands with that actually. In Karnataka it's called Kadgol. In Maharashtra it's called Ravi. Ravi, and I don't know what else you call it. Anything else?
Rajasthan is called
Ghotni. Huh? Okay. This is how we are getting butter. Just to show you, we use this every day to get our butter out from buttermilk. This much butter comes out from about 7 to 8 liters, more than that. More butter than that. From 7 to 8 liters of milk. This is some of our vegetable on the side. Vegetable stand. Vegetables from our place. Anyway, we can finish this. Some pole beans that we grow. This is dry land area. Okay. Okay, if you, shall I go to handlooms now? Yeah, if anyone has any questions on the section. See, agricultural implements, every area has their own. In a very intense area, you have different kinds of implements. In other areas, you have different implements, depending on which area you're cultivating. But these are things that we need to know. And the carpenters who know how to make them are gone, are going away. Until unless we kind of revive them, we will lose all these things. And the same thing will become very expensive and very industrialized. It will take us a long time to recover all these things. And we're on the verge of losing most of it.
Probably
U.S.
is
going to
take a patent after
reviving
these
patents.
Maybe devotees can do it better.
Okay. I've heard that it's not good to use steel implement in the earth. It's like earthing Mother Bhumi or something. You know, like the wood actually makes your earth stronger, but it's like putting a knife in the earth or something.
So there are two things. If you are using if you're using cow dung in your soil, if you're regularly manuring your soil with cow dung, at least I can tell you about my soil, the soil that we worked on. First year when we came into the soil, it was a eucalyptus plantation. And it was so hard. That soil was so hard. We had to use steel kind of stuff, huge ones to get the soil to turn around. Now 3 or 4 years down the line, now our soil is like butter. But all the other neighbors have the same problem. Therefore, you have to use steel. But when you're using enough of cow dung, you don't have to. Your soil will become like soft, like butter. And you'll just love to see your soil. Just turn it around and you feel so wonderful with your soil.
Where's the tip of the...
Tip is the steel. Iron is steel. But there are people who use even complete wooden also. If your soil is very good, very soft, you can do it.
Where's the tip of the...
Yes, team is so actually that's the reason why these heavy kind of plows have come into India. Ever since we started using fertilizers, the soil is becoming harder and harder and harder. And therefore it's requiring a lot of endeavor to plow the land. In fact, we've become, you know, getting all these steel factors, which is even more compacting the soil.
The more we did from the north,
yes.
The more problems.
And the second thing, if you use cow dung on your soil, around your ground, around your fields, you can grow so many things. On one crop of rice, you can grow dals, you can grow so many vegetables, you can so many things grow in one crop. Whereas with fertilizer, you can hardly grow one crop. And it's basically growing on fertilizer and water. Nothing else grows. So your soil and implements are also, these things are dying away because of use of too much of fertilizers. These technologies, they're becoming impractical to use these kind of technologies because your soil is too useless, too hard. So you cannot use these wooden implements anymore. So you need to use all the steel implements. And as you said, destroying Mother Earth. Okay, another thing about varieties of crops. In India, at the time of independence, there were, believe it or not, 2 lakh varieties of rice, which grows from the lowest rainfall area to the coldest place of Ladakh, you know, with minus 20 degrees, 30 degrees temperature. There's rice growing in every part of India, every altitude of different types. In Maharashtra, Sri Anandpur was mentioning, but they have, someone has discovered one group of Adivasis who have 150 varieties of rice and they're medicinal. And if you have a stomach problem, you take a particular variety of rice. If you have a cold problem, you take some other variety of rice. So different varieties of rice are available. And I think now the government is trying to push something called medicinal rice. The government is trying to promote medicinal rice. I still left probably a person called Richaria. He had collected about 35,000-40,000 just to 1998 when he left his body in India.
40,000.
In every district of India, there was at least 4,000 varieties of rice.
And in the seed banking, because the seed after a certain time...
You have to keep it in situ. You have to keep it in wood.
So they have all those institutes that keep...
They are doing that. A lot of it has gone to the Philippines. A lot of it has...
You go to the shops now, like around here, you're like 4 or 5 varieties.
Yeah. Actually, India has come down to about major 150 varieties right now. It's major, mostly cultivated. And very soon you will be complete. And previously people would do this, the following thing. You take the rice, boil it in the morning, and take that, what do you call it, the page, or what do you call it, the kanji. Kanji, what do you call it?
Man.
You know the extra water in the rice?
Yeah.
They would drink that in the morning for breakfast. And take the rice to the field. And that page or that, what do you call it, the gruel, the rice gruel that was there, so not nutritious that they could work the morning and afternoon on that.
Yeah.
Now it's throwing it out or doing something out of it, and that has no strength anyways. And there's so many varieties of rice. In Assam, there's a variety of rice which is called soft rice in Assam. After you dehusk it and get it ready, when you're traveling, just carry it with you. Whenever you want, just soak it in water for 15 minutes, just cold water, and it becomes so wonderful and tasty. That once you taste that rice, you will not like to taste anything else. So there's so many varieties of rice today available that we are losing all these things today very soon. And just coming up to another aspect is that wheat, or any flour practically, if you're grinding it and using it for chapatis or rotis, it should be used within 36 hours. Anything used after that is practically useless. It's as good as, some people say, as good as eating newspaper. So you just eat newspaper. And what to speak about is noodles that we have, this fast food noodles, that is, I think, it's wire mesh.
I think you said after grinding.
Yeah, after grinding within 36 hours, it has to be eaten. 36 is the last.
The atta.
Yes.
They say 6 months.
Yeah, that's why we read newspaper, we eat newspaper also. This is about 6, yes. Okay. Prabhupada said, basically, if you look into instructions of Srila Prabhupada, he has three basic instructions, I would say five basic instructions for rural communities or rural families, rural activities. He says, grow your own food, make your own cloth, build your houses from locally available material. No luxuries, no luxuries, no luxuries. Save time to chant Hare Krishna. If we don't do this, then we have to spend a lot of time collecting money and trying to buy our provisions and things like that. And it wastes a lot of time. So now anyway, let's come back to cotton. The cotton that is mostly used today is called the Egyptian cotton. Now, what is the distinction between Egyptian cotton and all the other cotton that is available is that the fiber within the cotton is about 2 inches long, whereas all the other cotton is about 1.5 inches, below 1.5 inches and below 2 inches. So that's why Egyptian cotton is supposed to be the best, which was introduced into India by the British. Of course, you get very thin thread from it. But the Indian variety, there are some Varalakshmi and some other varieties are there, which the fiber is a little thinner. Shorter, thinner. And of course, the fiber that you get is a little more thicker. Now, I'll give you an example of what is the advantage of using this kind of thread in your cloth, which is called khadi. There's a difference between khadi and handloom. Khadi is hand-spun thread and hand-woven. That is called khadi. Handloom is machine-spun thread and hand-woven. That's the difference between khadi and handloom. Now, I'll give you an example of what it does, what this does to your thread and does to your cloth. When you use cloth, when you bring a cloth, for example,
I bring my cloth,
it will hold less moisture or water.
But if it is looser like this, then it will hold more. So in the machines, we spin it more.
So therefore, the absorption of sweat and grime into our body is less.
Less of sweat and grime is actually absorbed by the body.
Other than that, silk. Silk is another thing that can be used, but you have to be careful because most of the silk that you get commercially is Himsa silk, in which to kill the worms, they put it in the hot water. And then they take out the silk, because otherwise if they wait for the worms to come out, they cut the silk, a cocoon. Therefore you get very short fibers. So normally, there is only one variety which is naturally Ahimsa silk, which is called Eri, or Tassar, which is, I think, probably these are Tassar, I think. Or Spun silk, in which you wait for the worm to go out, and then the cut is then again used like cotton and gets spun again, and use this. Now, 70% of the dye stuff that we use for coloring our clothes has been found to be carcinogenic. And it's banned in a lot of countries, except in India. In India, they use it randomly. In dyeing of clothes, there are basically three steps. First is modulant, which is used modern. The modern prepares the cloth for dyeing, and then it is dyed. And then to make the color fast, another process is taking place. And there are a lot of vegetable dyes in India, but they are, of course, dying away. I heard Rajasthan is still alive. I just got information yesterday. I would like to go send someone to learn this. Anyway, let me tell you about the spinning system. This charkha, which is the famous charkha of Gandhiji, which was symbol of India's independence, or fight for India's independence, we tried for 4 months and we couldn't get a charkha like this. 4 months we looked into every nook and corner. It's not manufactured anywhere. You can't get anyone to make this. We found this in some old homes. They'd thrown it away as some kind of garbage or some kind of thing. We finally found this and got them around. We got two of these right now. This is the oldest kind of charkha. And now they are coming up with other kind of modernized charkhas in which they use half modernized fiber. Cotton is half processed into thin sheets, and then they put it in, you get 6 to 8 threads out of that. It's hand-driven still, but that is modernized. The production is a little low, but they say that if you sit on this every day for 15 minutes per day, in 1 year you make enough thread to make 150 meters of cloth. So only by spending 15 minutes a day, you can spin 150 meters
woods on
like a 250 meter long. So I mean, but that's just spinning. What about spinning and the other one that you're
weaving? After this is weaving. After this, it goes into a few more processes. After this, you put it into a lady.
The first process is when they make the thread, right? You saw the first image, you see somebody with some cotton.
No, that is also a charkha. That's a modernized charkha that you get in water. That's a, what do you call it, a laptop or a notebook charkha.
It becomes small like this, you carry it around, you sit down and you start spinning.
Oh.
I was thinking of bringing it, but because I had a really bad back, I didn't bring it.
So there's only basically the charaka process and then the waving.
No, charaka, you first spin, then the thread you spin, and you put into ladies of 1 yard each. You put them into round, like
you have your Brahmin threads, but that much like that you have round ladies. Then they go in for starching, you got to starch them.
And then after you starch them, then you put them into beams like this. No, this one at the bottom, on the left hand side, the other side, extreme, the round one, yes. Now, this is a frame loom. This is a little modernized loom. Actually, older than this, I didn't take a picture of that. Older than that was pit looms, which you can see here around my room. Yeah. You can see a person sits inside the ground. And then you see the thread just coming out onto his angan, the courtyard. And that this kind of a system is more industrialized. They can have up to 500 to 800 meters on this beam. For this smaller looms, they can do about 10, 20, 30 meters in a day. One or two saris in a day. I think that is better because this is kind of becomes monotonous. The man becomes like a machine himself. Just
you mean the one that you just throw the thing like that and then throw
yes.
it to the other side like that?
Yes. Okay. So a person normally does about 8 to 10 meters per day. Working about 5-6 hours a day.
Basically, people would do just that 15 minutes a day, and then for like a week, they make that class.
The best time to spin your cotton, because weaving is not good during the rainy season. So the best time to spin your yarn is in the rainy season. You get very good yarn at that time. And the rest of the year, you can weave whenever you want.
There's another reason why we try to become popular.
Yes.
So weaving usually. Traditionally, they would do it like, you know, 1 week they would wait for the whole year, or it's more something like every day they'd come and do a few minutes and, you know, like...
Well, different places and different traditions. Some people were only into spinning yarn, or the children and the women, some people in the home, which who cannot do the weaving part, they do that, and the rest of them do this.
And I think traditionally that was done after food, no? Like after relaxing, after prashad, we would talk and... do that for like 15 minutes to relax, isn't it?
Good culture. Okay, so anything else? Yeah, should I end?
Yeah, but it's good.
There's other things also I can talk about, handmade paper. Prabhupada said this also, you should make your own paper.
Papers?
Yes, you can make your own ink, You can make your own pens. What else do you want?
Pens?
Yeah, pen.
Kalam,
right.
Kalam or pens?
Kalam, boru. Yes, using cow urine. Using cow urine, you can make more ink. There's another thing to talk about, different kinds of paper that was used. What Srila Rupa Goswami and others used was talpatra, or leaves, or palm leaves. And then they wrote with metal on top of it. And then they put carbon on top of it. Carbon grains, basically from chula or something. They put on top of it. And that they're still surviving in Vrindavan, you can see them. And other
you
people
make
use
your slogan card, you know.
You cannot carry them so much because they will actually get spoiled. But you write them and they'll survive for only 500 years now. The other traditions in Assam, there's called they use the bark of the oburu tree. Oburu is a wonderful scent we hear in Krishna book in different places. The tree itself is very wonderful scent, and if you burn it, it smells wonderful. It's got big demand in the Middle East. The Muslim countries like it, like anything. So the bark of that is used to make paper. And they use ink of different types. In Arunachal Pradesh, they still make paper from certain plants.
It's a tree that takes a very long time to grow.
Yes. It's actually the cost of gold now, practically. It is sold in tolas. Like you sell gold in tolas,
small micrograms of that.
Oh, Guru. Oh, Guru.
Seeds, yeah.
For the price of gold.
Oh, I don't have it here. It's still growing at in Assam. It's in the forest department of Assam. It's very expensive now. It's more expensive than sandalwood.
You know, like in the Second World War, right? I mean, in America and in Europe, they used a lot of hemp. And then before the whole marijuana thing, and they made it illegal and all that. But hemp was used even in the, I have a feeling like in the Second World War, they were inducing everybody to produce hemp because we needed fiber for the war effort for boats and also the stuff. So as India, as a tradition, because mostly come from here, right?
I don't know about hemp so far. I've heard about it, but I've not used it.
This is the longest fiber that exists, I think.
Sun hemp, yeah. I don't know. You have something about it?
It's like marijuana, but a different kind.
How do you make ropes?
They make ropes in Gujarat. I mean, sorry, in Gujarat.
Jute is also
used.
Jute
is also used. Okay, there's other things about handmade paper that you can use and beaters. I have a... we have a design on which you can make handmade paper about 100 kilos a day using bull power. Bull power.
That would be the best thing.
Yes.
Can this paper for the our school here in Mayapur all on both
of them?
You can make 100 kilos of...
We're studying all the crafts in school.
Of paper, every day. Amazingly, Prabhupada talked about handmade paper, and I did all this work on finding out how to make handmade paper, and I found out a quote, which agrees with what they found out. The best paper you can make is from cotton. And Prabhupada said it.
Cotton.
Yeah, grass also, but he said the best paper you can get from cotton. Prabhupada knew everything.
We've got 7 minutes left.
So, any questions or comments? Anything else? Yes. Gandhiji was really into making toilets in the villages because he didn't like the idea of people going out. So all these ideas, he's a Gandhian man, the man in Udupi. He's a Gandhian, so he has got this idea. In Haribhakti Vilas, it mentions that towards the Niruti side of your village, you should go 60 steps out of that area and do the work there. Sorry? Yeah, I mean, there have to be separated areas. Srila Prabhupada writes in the purport that no one does that work in the house. Out house? You can try. There's a group of people called, I think they have a institute or some kind of forum called TID. They're promoting what they call compost toilets. You can try that. They are doing it.
I was asked for Tarek Ashra when we went to the University of Shivan Kinika. I was for the other university, they have outside, but they have like one swimming pool, no? Of 1 meter high. After they have lilies. Yes. And cover everything, no? And that's very in 15, depending on how many people are there to keep the black water, no? But say about the 90% of the mayor and everything. And after that, the water can be used for water use. And they have
and they've also done similar things here. They have made it into, they separate the water part and the substance part, and they process it separately.
And after with the videos, they make compost, compost for animals, and for the land, many things.
In India, the Senate is also.
You have to make paper also. Yes. And grow very, very
good. But fast. So there are all things that we can do. We have seeds to collect, we have implements to learn, we have technologies to work on, we have cloth to make, we have dyes to make, we have health and herbs to get. We have so many things. I think Vipul the other day went to processing contact with some person who was able to do bloodless and plainless tooth extraction. He hasn't learned it as yet, but it's possible. In Rajasthan. So please take whatever you can.
Can we have an institute for all these technologies?
Yeah, it's called the Varnashram.
Great, sir. Thank you very much for coming this afternoon. We'll start again at 4 o'clock, and we can have Pritchi Bhattacharya to do the principal of the Bhaktivedanta Academy Gurukula. He's going to come and explain to us with some pictures and some demonstration about Vedic curriculum. So thank you very much. See you later. Hare Krishna.
Thank you.